From Sapporo, Japan. Debito.org podcast for May 1st, 2010. Happy May Day, everybody. Today I'm going to read you two of my articles and one more article that is not by me, but it places my other article in context. Let's start with my first article. This is Ni-chan Litter, The Bullies Forum, which came out on Wednesday, February 4th, 2009. Bullying in Japan is a big problem. The victims have limited recourse. Too often they are told to suck it up and self-reflect. Or if they fight back, they get criticized for lashing out. It's a destructive dynamic, causing much misery and many a suicide. The bullies are empowered by an odd phenomenon. In Japan, the right to know your accuser is not a given. When kids get criticized by the anonymous rumor mill, authorities make insufficient efforts to disclose who said what. The blindfolded bullied become powerless. There are lots of them and one of you, and unless you put names to critics, they escalate with impunity. Internet bulletin board Ni-chan Litter, the world's largest, is the ultimate example of this dynamic. Although the BBS is very useful for public discussions, its debate firestorms also target and hurt individuals. This flurry of bullies is guaranteed anonymity through undisclosed internet protocol addresses, meaning they avoid the scrutiny they mete out to others. Why is there absolute anonymity? Ni-chan Litter's founder and coordinator, Hiroyuki Nishimura, believes it liberates debate and provides true freedom of speech. People speak without reservation because nobody knows who they are. Well, quite. But freedom of speech is not absolute. It does not grant freedom to lie or deceive, as in fraud, nor to engage in malicious behavior designed to hinder calm and free discourse. The classic example is the lack of freedom to shout fire in a crowded theater. But libel and slander, also where people willfully lie to assassinate characters and destroy lives, is also beyond the pale. Japan does have checks against libel. Lawsuits. Dozens of civil court cases have been brought against Ni-chan Litter. When a problematic post appears, victims contact the BBS coordinator and request its removal. Alas, many get ignored. Then, when taken to court, Nishimura ignores summons to appear. Finally, even after losing dozens of times in court, Nishimura refuses to pay out. Years later, adjudged libelous posts, some about your correspondence, are still online and proliferating. Well, how is this possible? The internet is a new media, and the judiciary just hasn't caught up. If a newspaper or TV station publicizes erroneous information, they too can be sued. But the old media are more accountable. They have to register the corporation and get a license, so the wherewithal's whereabouts is public. And if they lose and don't pay, the court will file a lien on their assets and withdraw the award for the plaintiffs. However, in cyberspace, people can start a quote-unquote media outlet without incorporation or licensing, meaning their assets remain invisible. Nishimura owes millions of dollars in court penalties. But unless he divulges his personal bank accounts, his wages can't be seized. This dynamic becomes watertight thanks to a weakness in Japan's judiciary. In this case, one cannot convert a civil suit into a criminal case through contempt of court. No cops will arrest Nishimura for being on the lam. Plaintiffs must hire their own private detectives to dig up Nishimura's assets. No checks, no balances, and the bully society remains above the law. The abuses continue. Last month, cops decided to arrest a two-channeler who issued a death threat against sumo wrestler Asashoryu. It's about time. Hate posters have long vilified ethnic minorities, threatened individuals, and waged cyber wars to deny others the freedom of speech they apparently so cherish. Meanwhile, Nishimura keeps on wriggling. Last month, he announced Ni-chan Litter's sale to a Singaporean firm, making his assets even more unaccountable. While some salute Nishimura as a hero and an evangelist, he's also a willing abettor in the pollution of cyberspace, legitimizing an already powerful domestic bully culture with a worldwide audience. He had his day in court to explain himself. He didn't show. He lost. Now he must pay up. If not, there will be blowback. Our government has already made reactionary overtures to limit quote-unquote illegal or harmful content, whatever that means, on the internet. Be advised, once you get the unsophisticated Japanese police a vague mandate over anything, you'll have random enforcement and policy creep as usual. Kaplui goes cyber freedom of speech. Unless contempt of court procedures are tightened up to reflect the realities of the new media, I believe Nishimura will be remembered historically as the irresponsible kid who spoiled the internet for the rest of us. And now let's take a look at the second article I'm going to read to you today. It is not by me. It is by Gregory Clark, another columnist in the Japan Times. This is his column of Thursday, January 15th, 2009. And quite honestly, it's one of the worst articles I've ever read in the Japan Times, and it occasioned my next column, which I'll be reading shortly afterwards. And the reason why it's so bad is it's just bad science. Here goes. The title is Anti-Foreigner Discrimination is a Right for Japanese People. Gaijin Girai, as in dislike of Japan, is an allergy that seems to afflict many Westerners here. If someone handing out Japanese language flyers assumes they can't read Japanese and ignores them, they cry racial discrimination. If they are left sitting alone on a train, they assume that is because the race is Japanese, do not want to sit next to foreigners. If someone does sit next to them and tries to speak to them in English, they claim more discrimination, this time because it is assumed they cannot speak Japanese. Normally these people do little harm. In their gaijin ghettos, they complain about everything from landlords reluctant to rent to foreigners, ignoring justified landlord fear the damage foreigners can cause, to the use of the word gaijin, forgetting the way some English speakers use this shorter and sometimes discriminatory word foreigner rather than foreign national. A favorite complaint is that Japanese universities discriminate against foreigners. Well, how many Western universities would employ, even as simple language teachers, foreigners who could not speak, write, and read the national language? And recently they have revived the story of how they bravely abolished anti-foreigner discriminations from bathhouses in the port town of Otaru in Hokkaido. Since I was closely involved, allow me to throw some extra light on that affair. An onsen manager who had allegedly earlier been driven to near bankruptcy by badly behaved Russian sailors had decided this time to bar all foreigners from his new enterprise. The activist, singular, then filed a suit for mental distress and won $3 million in damages. In the Zeitgeist and letter pages of this newspaper, some have criticized these excessively zealous move by the activists. These critics, in turn, have been labeled as favoring Nazi-style discrimination and mob rule. Maybe it is time to bring some reality to this debate. Otaru had been playing host to well over 20,000 Russian sailors a year, most arriving in small rust bucket ships to deliver timber and pick up second-hand cars, thus written. I visited the wharves there, and as proof that I harbor no anti-Russian feeling, let me add that I speak Russian and enjoy talking to these earthy, rough-hewn people in their own language. Even so, the idea of them demanding freedom to walk into any onsen bathhouse of their choice, especially to a high-class onsen like Yunohara, note, the name's wrong, it's not Yunohara, it's Yunohana, so much for being closely involved, is absurd. The anti-discrimination activists say bathhouse managers can solve all problems by barring drunken sailors. But how do you apply a drunk test? And how do you throw out a drunk who has his foot in the door? Besides, drunken behavior is not the only bathhouse problems with these Otaru sailors. I can understand well why regular Japanese customers seeking the quiet Japanese-style camaraderie of the traditional Japanese bathhouse would want to flee an invasion of noisy, bathhouse-ignorant foreigners. and since it is not possible to bar only Russians, barring all foreigners is the only answer. The anti-discrimination people point to Japan's acceptance of a UN edict banning discrimination on the basis of race. But that edict is broken every time any U.S. organization obeys the affirmative action law demanding preference for blacks and other minorities. Without it, U.S. President-elect Barack Obama would probably not be where he is today. I see, so thanks for the favor, I guess. Until Obama didn't get on his own merits. Malaysia has also ignored it, with its Bumiputra policy of favoring Malays over Chinese and other minorities. There are dozens more examples of societies deciding to favor one group of people over others in order to preserve solidarity or prevent injustices. A large chain of barbershops in Japan has signs saying service is denied to those who do not speak Japanese. Non-Japanese speakers probably cause much less harm to a business than delinquent Russians, but we do not see our activists in action there. The activists say there should be action to educate Russian sailors in bathhouse behavior. Actually, no, we didn't say that. But do we see any of the activists in these friendship societies where worthy Japanese citizens try to ease problems for foreigners living there? Not as far as I know. No, you don't. Presumably, close contact with these citizens would also upset their Japan Gidai feelings. In Otaru, the obvious answer from the beginning was to create a seamen's club, similar to those that exist in many major ports. But there, too, the activists were very silent. No, we weren't. It seems that they prefer to move against weak targets, where they can gain publicity with a minimum of effort. One result, either of the intensity of their beliefs or of their self-aggrandizement urges, is the vitriol they pour on those who have criticized their actions, like you. Sometimes their activism goes beyond even the absurd. Japan has long had a real problem of clever Chinese and Korean criminals taking advantage of Japan's lack of theft awareness to pick the locks and pockets of suspecting citizens. But when the authorities try to raise this problem, they too are accused of anti-foreigner discrimination. Even companies advertising pick-proof locks are labeled as discriminators if they mention the Chinese lock-picking problem. That's at variance with the record. Obviously, Japan needs precautions against these theft experts. Many, myself included, dislike the fingerprinting of foreigners at airports. But this, too, is needed to stop criminally-minded foreigners from re-entering Japan after they have been caught and expelled. If anything, the authorities are too lenient with these people. Ellipsis. Let me add that I also have no anti-China feeling. I speak Chinese, too. See what I mean about the science? It's time we admitted that at times the Japanese have the right to discriminate against some foreigners, and if they do not, and Japan ends up like our padlocked, mutually suspicious Western societies, we will all be the losers. That's one person's opinion, not mine, though. And I wrote a response to it. This is my Just Because column of Wednesday, March 4th, 2009 in the Japan Times. And it is entitled, Of Toadies, Vultures, and Zombie Debates. If there's one thing execrable in the marketplace of ideas, it's quote-unquote zombie debates. Discussions long dead, exhumed by Dr. Frankensteins posing as serious debaters. Take the recent one about racial discrimination. When you consider the human rights advances of the past 50 years, it's settled, long settled. Yet regurgitated is the same old guff. We must separate people by physical appearance and treat them differently, because another solution is inconceivable. Or, it's not discrimination, it's a matter of cultural understandings, and anyone who objects is a cultural imperialist. And, discrimination maintains social order or follows human nature. Bunkum. We've had 165 countries sign an agreement at the United Nations defining what racial discrimination is and committing themselves to stop it. That includes our country, Japan. We've had governments learn from historical example, creating systems for abolition and redress. We've even had one apartheid government abolish itself. In history, these are all fixed stars. There is simply no defense for racial discrimination within civilized countries. Yet, as if in a bell jar, the debate continues in Japan. This nation is somehow unique due to historical circumstance, geographic accidents, or purity of race or method, or bullying foreigners who hate Japan take advantage of peace-loving, effete Japanese, or racial discrimination is not illegal in Japan, so there. Well, actually, that one is true. A good liberal arts education should have fixed this. It could be that the most frequent proponents, internet denizens, have a fluid morality. Their attitude towards human rights depends on what kind of reaction they'll get online, or how well they've digested their last meal. But who cares? These mass debaters are not credible sources, brave enough to append their real names and take responsibility for their statements. They're easily ignored. Harder to ignore are some pundits in established media who clearly never bought into the historical training found in all developed, and many developing, multicultural societies. That racial discrimination is simply not an equitable or even workable system. However, in Japan, where history is ill-taught, these scribblers flourish. The ultimate irony is that it's often foreigners who stand to lose the most from discrimination, making the most racist arguments. They wouldn't dare say the same things in their countries of origin, but by coupling, one, the cultural relativity and tolerance training found in liberal societies with, two, the innate guestism of fellow outsiders, they try to reset the human rights clock to zero. Well, why do it? What do they get from apologism? Certainly not more rights. Well, some apologists are culture vultures, and posturing is what they do. Some claim a cultural emissary status, as in, only I truly understand how unique Japan is and how it deserves exemption from the pantheon of human experience. Then the poseurs seek their own unique status as an oracle for the less cultured. And then there are the toadies, the disenfranchised cozying up to the empowered and the majority. It's simple. Tell the natives what they want to hear. You're special, even unique, and any problems are somebody else's fault. And look, you can enjoy the trappings of the club without ever having any real membership in it, while pulling up the ladder behind you. It's an easy sell. People are suckers for pinning the blame on others. For some toadies, croaking, "It's a foreigner's fault," has become a form of Tourette's syndrome. That's why this debate, continuously looped by a tiny minority, is not only zombified, it's stale and boring, thanks to its repetitiveness and preposterousness. For who can argue with a straight face that some people, by mere dint of birth, deserve an inferior place in a society? Answer, those with their own agendas, who care not one whit for society's weakest members. Like Comprador bourgeoisie, apologists are so caught up in the game that they've lost their moral bearing. Look, these people don't deserve equal time in places like this newspaper. The media doesn't ask, for the sake of balance, a lynch mob to justify why they lynched somebody. Because what they did was illegal. Racial discrimination should be illegal too in Japan, under our constitution. However, because it's not, yet, apologists take advantage, amorally parroting century-old discredited mindsets to present themselves as good gaijin. Don't fall for it. Japan is no exception from the world community and its rules. It admitted as such when it signed international treaties. The debate on racial discrimination is dead. Those who seek to resurrect it should grow up, get an education, or be ignored for the subterfuge. Boy, that sort of stuff makes me hot under the collar. Let's give you another Duran Duran song. This is a song called Canada, K-H-A-N-A-D-A, and it came out in the mid-80s. Pretty surprising little piece. Have a listen. We'll be right back. right, and that'll do it for today's podcast for May 1st, 2010. Thanks to everyone for listening. Enjoy your Golden Week. Bye-bye.